When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coit in conversation with Mark Cavendish on Talk Sport.
Today on My Sporting Life, one of our best ever cyclists and one of the greatest the Tour de France has ever seen. Born on the Isle of Man on the 21st of May 1985, a world champion on the track at the age of 20, followed by another gold alongside Bradley Wiggins in 2008 and again in 2016. As a road cyclist, he's the best sprinter there's ever been. 11 wins in his first pro season in 2005, road race world champion 2011, that year the Sports Personality of the Year and made an MBE, Olympic silver medalist, one of the true greats of the Tour de France. And just when people wrote him off, came back to win four stages in 2021, which puts him with 34 stage wins, the joint most successful Tour de France cyclist there's ever been. He is the Manx missile, Mark Cavendish. How are you, Mark?
I'm in a bit of pain, I'm not going to lie to you.
Now, I should mention at the time we're recording this, we're just a couple of weeks on from very nasty crash in the Velodrome in Ghent at the six-day meeting in Belgium. You come off the bike at speed, paramedics came running on. You had two broken ribs, punctured lung, and looking at you, I'd never know. How are you up and about?
Just got to get on with it. Ribs are ribs. Like, ribs, they're just painful. They're not doing any health damage, really. They're just painful. The lung, obviously, I've got to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate it wasn't a complete deflation, then you need all the drains in and all that, because then that's a bit more recovery. But they heal pretty quickly, you know, and it's almost like you could say it sounds worse than it is. Like, it's not, you don't want a hole in your lung, you know.
Yeah.
And the hole is just behind the heart, so it's hard to kind of keep an eye on and that, but it usually heals all right. And that's more of a health, that doesn't cause any pain, it's more of a health issue. But I'm all right, I'll survive. Like, the irony that it happened with 30 minutes to go of my whole season, not just that race, my whole season. It was the last 30 minutes of my season that started in January, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was due a week, 10 days off anyway. It'll just be a little bit longer. I'll be able to get, I reckon, by next week, I'll be on Zwift indoors on the indoor trainer, you know, and turning my legs again. It was quite good at happening this time of the year and not kind of in the season like it's happened in the past, not in the middle of the Tour de France.
Let's go back to when you were a kid. Was there cycling in the family?
Nothing at all.
Is that right?
Nothing. My brother rode, like, don't get me wrong, like, my parents were kind of supportive in sports with us. They didn't push us to do sports. Actually, quite the opposite. They want us to do something academic. But they always supported with what we want to do. We were always doing something like football, athletics. I did ballroom dancing even, you know. I didn't really start cycling until I was like 11.
Mm.
But when I think back now, I was always on a bike before that. I was just obsessed with it.
Do you remember what your first bike was?
That very first bike was like this little red and white girl's bike.
Right.
Had a, like, just...
little bell on the top?
I think it probably did, you know.
Tassels,
might even had a basket.
On the handle,
no tassels. I think it might have had a basket. I'm not sure. But I had a white saddle, white, and it was red. And that's what I learned on. And then straight away, it was BMXs after that, really.
Sure.
You know, not top of the range stuff, you know. We weren't that well off, really. But we... yeah, we always had a bike, which was nice. You know, we were always out on it. There's not much else to do on the Isle of Man, to be fair.
So how does it go from there to thinking, you know what, this kid's pretty fast. And I mean, it's like a discovery. I don't know whether someone discovers you or you discover this, or there's, firstly, I imagine there's a will to win, because everybody that I speak to opposite always has this, I need to win, even if I'm playing against the kids, I've got to win everything. Was it the same with you?
That, oh, growing up, I didn't, had to be the best at everything.
Yeah.
Wasn't always the best at everything, but I always had to strive for it. Not just the best that I could do, I had to win.
I
had
and
to
hated losing?
Yeah, I really did. At everything. Even if it was like the spelling test at school or something. Yeah, I had to get the most, you know. I was always competitive. But yeah, the cycling, I don't know. Like, I started, yeah, like I said, I started when I was 11, like racing. And I was on a BMX and against road bikes and mountain bikes with gears.
Yeah.
There's a league on the Isle of Man. And they get like 150 kids a week down there. It's been going for years and years and years. And like two wheels is in the blood over there. Like, yeah. Motorbikes predominantly,
of course,
is the biggest thing with the TT. With
the
TT.
The TT mountain course is 37¾ miles around, and the riders must lap it 6 times. Here, the competitors are practicing and getting used to the course.
But bikes is, for a population of 80,000, like the amount of people ride bikes is quite phenomenal. And it's bad weather, you know.
Mm.
But yeah, I went to this league. I didn't win. I was on a BMX. I was last. And my mum was laughing at me, actually. She was there. She's like laughed. And I was like, yeah, if I had gears, you know, I could compete.
Mm.
And I asked for a bike with gears for me birthday. And it's a bit irrelevant, but the day after my birthday, it was raining, but I still went down and no one was there. It was cancelled. So I had to wait another week. I went down the week after. And I won straight away, you know, down there. And then the year after, I went over to the mainland UK to race, and I won there as well. And then when I was 13, I went to more races, and it wasn't even a case of I was winning under 14 races. I used to ask if I could race the under 16s instead of the under 14s.
Yeah.
And I'd win them as well, you know. And then that's when I was like 13, like there's a difference between, you know, you're quite good at something, and then you know when you quite good at something. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, of course, like, it does. Yeah.
Like straight away then, like I knew what I wanted to do.
So is there, it goes off in you and you're thinking, there's something in this. You know what? I seem to beat everybody. There's something in this.
Yeah, well really, but even then it wasn't like a dream of fame or grandeur, because cycling was a niche sport then. Yeah. You know, a bunch of weirdos in Lycra, like, you know, there was no money. Like pro cyclists weren't rich, you know.
You weren't wearing Lycra at this point, though, were you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Oh, I loved it, like, you know. Didn't have hair on my legs, but I was still shaving them, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, so then that was it. I made a decision. I'm going to be a cyclist. I knew I could do it. And, like, it was doing my option for my GCSEs.
Mm.
And the biggest team at the time was Deutsche Telekom was. And there was two teams. There was US Post, who Lance Armstrong rode for, and they went for the GC, the general classification, Ineos did, or Team Sky, you know? And then Telecom were like, my team, Quickstep Now, or HTC in the past, they went for everyone. You know, they supported sprinters. And I knew then that I couldn't really go uphill. Like, physiologically, I was a sprinter.
You are built as a sprinter, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you look at me compared to a normal person, like, okay, my bottom half is quite muscly.
Yeah.
But I'm like a small boy on top. Do you know what I mean? But compared to the mountain guys,
yeah,
I'm actually well built, like, you know. It's a physiological thing.
So did you learn this, though, Mark? I mean, is there someone that's telling you all this, or is this what you're gaining as you go along and you're thinking, well, I know that this is how it works, and you're having to just do all your own research? Or when you're a teenager, you're within a team and then someone's saying, you know, this is how you're built. This is what you should be.
You fall into it. When you're a kid, even when you're on junior, even as an amateur, you kind of win across all terrains. You do everything.
Yeah.
You know, it's all, not until you turn pro that you kind of, that you specialise, because you got the best of everything.
Mm.
And that's the same in every sport. You know, probably like a football player could play in any position when they're a schoolboy.
Yeah.
You know, they're just good at playing football. But once they turn professional, there's a better striker than you. There's a better defender. You fit into a category. And that's the same in cycling. Like, but I was always destined to be a sprinter. And that's why, like, going back to it, like, as doing my GCSEs, And I decided to take German because I wanted to write for Deutsche Telekom. And so I learned German at that age, at 13, 14, you know. And I had my career path mapped out then, what I was going to do, you know.
That's it's impressive for that age. So when did the Cycling Olympic Academy come? This is a little bit after that.
That was when I was like 18. Yeah. That was the only kind of stroke of luck thing that I hadn't planned out that came in. So I left school and I went to work at a bank. And that was to earn money. Like then, there was nothing like that when I was young. The way to make it was you pack your bag and you go and live in Europe and go to races and hopefully win races, get picked up, you know, by a team. So I planned to do that. I went to work at a bank and save money for a couple of years. And I did that and then planned to go to Holland or Belgium. And then this academy started, the British Cycling Academy. So they'd had Olympic success. And then it was about developing the young talent. It was the next step in the process. And they started the Olympic Academy. And I was one of the first intakes on that. That was when I was 18. That was like 2004. And then I went and I was unfit. I'd been working in a bank 2 years. And actually, you had to do lab tests and that to get in. You know, like power, data, numbers, you know.
Sure.
I didn't really succeed with them. But how I approached things was different, like my brain worked different and they kind of seen that, and they gave me an opportunity, just like how I described you had an interview process as well as physical kind of tests, and I was picked more on that than the physical stuff. And yeah, I turned up, I was the worst of everyone, but then in 1 year I was world champion when I went obviously full time then, was doing that, and when I could concentrate full time on work, you know, won the world championships the year after, so that was it then.
So Mark progressed well in the bicycle boot camp. There was the British Cycling Olympic Academy. And within 2 years, he was world champion. I'm Paul Coyce. More on that and his dream of riding the Tour de France, which went pretty well, on My Sporting Life with Mark Cavendish.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coyce in conversation with Mark Cavendish on Talk Sport.
It's 2003. And Mark spent 2 years working in a bank to try and save money towards his dream of becoming a professional cyclist. When, at 18, he's one of six young riders to be asked to join British Cycling's first ever Olympic Academy. So, Mark, how tough was this? Because I mentioned boot camp earlier, but was it basically like being in an army for cyclists?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah?
We had to live with the other riders. There was six of us, I think. And then, yeah, we had one bike to race and train that we had to, it was down to us to look after it. You take for granted as a professional, but we weren't professional.
Sure.
But most amateurs have that now, it's like professional setup. But it really makes you now, I can look back and appreciate how you have it as a professional. It's like having to clean the boot, like, you know, in the old days.
It's like old apprentice footballers.
Exactly. Yeah. When you're an apprentice, you have to clean the, I don't think that happens anymore, does it?
Don't have any,
do you know what I mean? But it makes you appreciate when you have it.
Sure.
It's exactly the same principle as that. And yeah, so it was like we were, if we stepped out of line, the punishment was extra training, you know? So obviously we're getting better at that. And where some people kind of could see that they thought that was spiteful, that we had to suffer more, like I've seen it as it's all helping us. Like it was all to make us better, you know? I embraced it, I loved it. I like a regime anyway, a plan, thing, how things go. And I kind of thrived off that, I guess.
What were you looking forward to here, Mark? I mean, are you thinking, I want to do this at the Tour de France, I want to do that, or is it just, I'm going to take it as it goes and I just want to be as successful as I can possibly be, whatever that is? Or was there a plan? Because you say you like plans, was there somebody that you're aiming for?
Well, it changed, obviously, because I said, like, the academy wasn't part of the plan that I'd set up. But my dream was to ride the Tour de France, was to be world champion. Like, that was what I'd said, you know. And like I said, I won the Worlds in a year, so that was done. And then it was about turning professional. Like, it was about turning professional on the road. And I turned professional for Deutsche Telekom, you know, what I'd said maybe 6 years previous. And yeah, that was it. I don't know. It's hard to talk about because it just seems normal, I guess, you know. It's what I wanted to do. I did it.
See, the thing is, it's always interesting when I talk to people that are so successful in sport, and it's almost like, and we'll get to this point where all of a sudden it's like, you know, everybody knows you, but does it just carry on? It's just like your job, this is how life goes, I just carry on, and it's just this stuff seems to happen around me.
Yeah,
well, it seems to be.
It always is like that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Even, I know we're going to talk about this year later.
Yeah.
But it's like the amount of people say, oh, things fell into place for me this year. and the stars aligned.
Mm.
I made them align. Like, and I hurt myself in the process doing it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I flew around space with no oxygen, burning my hands on stars to put them in the right line.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah, very.
And that's what I did when I was young. I knew where I wanted to go. I made sacrifices to make it happen, you know? Like, there was a time when I was 14, I finished school on a Friday, and I'd get a hold all, fill it, put it on my back like a rucksack, and then I'd be on my road bike, I'd have my track bike, my velodrome bike, with no brakes, fixed gears and that, in the other hand.
No.
Really? And I'd ride down to the ferry, and I'd go on the ferry, you see on the ferry with the truck drivers and that.
Yeah.
You get over at night, like, I was lucky, like, I had friends there that I could stay with in Liverpool, or some day, I remember one night, like, just waiting all night in the train station, you know, at Lime Street, and then getting the train, the race I wanted to do, and doing the race, staying over, doing another race on the Sunday, getting back. And if you won the race, like, instead of having a butty or a sandwich or something on the boat, I could get sausage and mash, like, you know?
Yeah.
And getting the ferry overnight, getting in early hours and going to school on the Monday, you know? I just did it. And at the time, it didn't feel like I was making a sacrifice. It's just what I had to do. You know,
and you're learning all the way through, I guess, and mentally as well, and also growing up as well, doing it.
Really, it gives you so many life experiences, like lessons, not just for your sport, but for everything. You know, like I said, I'm a father. I've got four kids, and determination, resilience is the biggest thing I want to instill into them.
Mm.
Not necessarily determination to win and be the best, but to have a drive to do what you want to do without boundaries. You know. Especially my daughter.
Sure.
I've got a daughter who obviously, unfortunately, have barriers close to her because she's a girl.
Mm.
Do you know? And I've got a strong wife that also is a massive influence on her to give her the ability to do what she wants to do in life, you know? And but with all the kids, like, as long as they commit 100%, I'll support them in whatever they want to do. And but all I ask is that they commit, you know.
So do you also look back at years, though? Do you look back and go, that was a great year, I'm very proud of what I did? Because I'm thinking of, like, 2011. And, well, I mean, it was a heck of a year for me, wasn't it? It really was.
Yeah, it was nice, yeah. It's crazy that it's 10 years since then, isn't it? You know?
You were just a kid, Mark. You were just a kid.
I was, yeah.
What stands out when you think about that? Was it the Worlds? Was it the Rainbow Jersey? Was it the, I mean, all the sports personality of the year right at the end of it? You know, we'll get onto the tour as well a little bit later, but what stands out when you think about that?
Yeah, winning the world title on the road is a big thing, you know. That's an exclusive club, I guess.
First,
you know,
time in about 50 years, wasn't it?
Yeah, for a British male rider. But I don't know. I've been fortunate to be part of some of the most incredible teams, both professionally and like my professional teams and my national teams.
Yeah.
Like that World Championships we had. Myself, Bradley Wiggins, Chris Froome, Steve Cummins, Geraint Thomas, Ian Stannis, David Miller, like the biggest names in the golden era of cycling, you know, the evolution of cycling, and in this country. And when I think of that's pretty special, you know. I've had some incredible teams, and so I can just be happy. I can look back and just be happy and content, I guess, you know, without kind of picking someone out and basking in it.
Yeah,
I don't want to bask in it. I'm happy.
Can you tell me though about that sprint, the final sprint? When we're talking 2011, you got the team with you, and I could. And it's almost. I know people have said about this photographic memory that you have because you remember every turn, everything about every course. Are you like that when you look back and you think of it now?
Yeah, I can still remember. I still remember losing the wheel of Geraint, who was my lead out man, Matt Goss, who was my professional teammate, he ran for Australia. I lost it to him. Like, I was squeezed between him and the barriers. I didn't want to crash, so I backed off.
And Cavendish is sitting a little bit far back at the moment, and it's going to get very tight on the barrier. Very, very tight indeed. This is super nervous.
And then waited for a gap to open, moved a couple of wheels up. Then there's a right-hand corner, about 700 to go. And then the road kicked up, like it's uphill. If you look at that road as a normal person, you go, that's a hill.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm guessing this is not what you want at the end, right? Is there a hill in front of you?
Not really, but the length of it, the speed we're going, need to sprint, I can sprint up it, you know. And, yeah, just waiting. And I was there maybe 10, 12 back.
Geraint Thomas looks over his shoulder to see where Cavendish is, and he's sitting behind the Australians at the moment into the final corner. Is he too far back? He almost collides with the Italian. He's going to come a long way around at the moment. Off Peel Stannard, it's Matt Heyman at the moment of Australia. Yeah. Setting this up, Heinrich Hausler on the outside. Cavendish is about 10 back.
But there's going to be a few lead-out men, the guys that pull their sprint to the end in front. So they're going to pull off, so that's going to knock me forward a little bit.
Yeah.
And then the wind was coming from the right, so the bunch is going to just naturally kind of swirl to the left.
Heinrich Hausler drives! He's going for the line now. Look on the left-hand side of your screen, that's where it's at!
Like, to kind of get out of the wind. And so knowing that and hoping that is the case, and just waiting for a gap to open and present itself, and then go, and that's what I did.
Cavendish has made his way through. Oh, he's done it. Cavendish has done it. He's going to be the world champion. Oh, it's yes. Mark Cavendish is the world champion.
Well, fortunately, I won, you know.
Fortunately is more than fortune. But when you see that gap and when you go for it, is this when you think, this is what I love? Is that in there, this is what I love doing? Because then you just put the afterburners on and you're away.
Not really. I can be romantic and kind of talk of it like that. It's quite the opposite.
Is it really?
Unemotional when you're doing it. Yeah, you know, you're just doing a process. You're putting a process into action. It's quite boring, really, and just doing it. And,
what about when you cross the line, though?
Yeah, then it all goes out. Yeah, and that's why you get, like, an outpour of emotion. If you win, like, ridiculous overkill and how much you're celebrating, you know. If you lose, then, you know, it's, you can see that as well, you know. And like with cycling, we're such a open sport to media. You don't go into the change rooms to cool off, then come out and do a press conference. Like, everything's there immediately, so you see that. And that's what's beautiful about it, you know. Like, I think as fans of sport, something I've learned actually quite recently, I was always consumed in what I was doing. And I knew people watched cycling. And I thought they were watching me live my journey. But you're in your bubble. Most sports people are like this, you know. Like, I can tell you, most football players think that fans are watching them play on the pitch.
Mm.
Whereas you're not. Like, fans are on the pitch with them. Yeah. You don't want to watch people's emotions. You want to feel those emotions. Mm. As a sports fan, that's what... And if you're a sports person,
yeah,
you disassociate from yourself as a sports fan.
Well, I mean, I'd be sitting at home... Going, go on, Kev, go on, Kev. I know you can't hear me, but I'm there when I'm doing it.
But it's been, do you know, it's been the most beautiful realisation, understanding that and feeling.
How recent is that then?
This year.
Oh, is that right?
And really, since I wasn't able to do it, really. Not just, I've felt it this year since I've been winning.
Yeah.
But I've understood it the last years when I wasn't winning, when I wasn't competing, when I was a fan, not an athlete, do you know? And I'm starting to get all like, expressive of you, and it's hurting me really.
Yeah,
so
go easy.
I'm going to have to calm down a bit.
Well, relax, take it easy, because when we return, we'll discuss the greatest race of them all with the man that's won more stages than any other in history and the greatest sprinter there's ever been, the Tour de France, next with Mark Cavendish on My Sporting Life.
My Sporting Life with Mark Cavendish on Talk Sports.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together.
J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coates in conversation with Mark Cavendish on Talk Sport.
Mark has had a huge 2011, became the first British World Road Race champion in 46 years. He's made an MBE, win Sports Personality of the Year, and his 20th Tour de France stage win as well. But before we focus on the Tour de France, Mark, which we'll do in just a second, I've got to be honest with you. I was working in the World Cycling Championship 2016 in London when a distinguished cycling journalist comes up to me and says, I'm just off to interview Mark Cavendish, but I'm not sure how he's going to be. And he seemed a little nervous to speak to you. Now, we're meeting for the first time today and I think we get on very well, but, you know, there are rumours that you've been difficult over the years, and has there been times when maybe the press have rubbed you up the wrong way?
I don't think it's the press.
What do you think?
It's not. It's individuals. It's the same in anything, you know. I'm a cyclist.
Yeah.
And how many people are going to be listening to this in their car and just think, oh, he's a cyclist. Like, I hate cyclists. Do you know?
I don't know now.
But because there's the odd dickhead on a bike.
Yeah.
And it spoils it for other cyclists. There's the odd dickhead in a car that spoils it for other drivers. So then drivers hate cyclists, cyclists hate drivers. Likewise, my profession, you got good journalists. Like I said before, you've done your own work, you know. And I give everything to my job, you know. And I expect that other people give everything to their job. And I will answer questions. I don't like doing interviews.
Hmm.
But it's my job to do interviews, do you know. And if you can feel like it's a conversation and someone respects what you're doing, that's nice. They're doing their job well. Like if they're just looking for a bite, or they haven't done their research, or it's
sure,
they're not doing their job. It's disrespectful. Not necessarily to me. It's disrespectful to other journalists.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because you're giving journalists a bad name. And it used to really rub me up the wrong way.
Was Tour de France tiredness a factor, perhaps?
No. Stop asking stupid questions. Do you know what that's like?
Don't get me wrong, I still don't like it now, but I don't let it bother me now, if that makes sense.
You're comfortable now, aren't
you? Well, I'm 36 years old. When you're 20 years old and you don't understand it and you've never had media training and you've been institutionalised for a few years, like I said, you're in your own little bubble as a sports person. You get older, you get married, you have kids, you have hard times, you suffer illness that ruins your career, mental health issues that ruin your career. You get a different perspective on life and things don't bother you in the same way, you know. And although I don't like it, if I don't like the things that I said before, what we'll say media do, or like I don't take it personally,
yeah,
like I did, you know. I, whereas I was fighting the world and taking things personally, I'm 36 years old now. Like the world's different, and ultimately it's individuals, it's not the media, do you know what I mean? And I understand now, there's no smoke without fire. Do you know, there's a reason I'd feel like that, whether it's my own chip on my shoulder or whatever. Like I said, there's no smoke without fire, so.
Let's talk about the Tour de France. You and the Tour de France, you're going to be forever linked. You know, you are, and going on in history, long after we've all gone, you're still going to be linked with the Tour de France. Does it live up to every expectation when you go to your first Tour de France? I remember that. I don't know if you've ever seen that there's an old film called Breaking Away, and it was an old cycling film, and I remember, and I always remember seeing it years ago, and I think Dennis Quaid was in it, and it was about this young cyclist, and he was desperate to be a professional cyclist.
Enrico Gimondi spends 8 hours a day training to be the finest racer in all of Italy. 20th Century Fox presents Breaking Away.
And the moment he got involved in this race, and there was an Italian team who he had pictures of on his wall, it kind of shattered into pieces because nobody really wanted to know him, and they were thinking, who's this kid coming along? Was there anything like that with you when you went into your first Tour de France? I mean, sure, you've been known and people knew who you were, but what was it like for you? Did it live up to everything you wanted it to be?
Well, it helped because I was in the biggest team in the world. You know, like, my first Tour de France started here in London.
The 2007 Tour de France, beginning today with a prologue of just under 5 miles. Arguably, they are two of the most interesting cities in the world, an end in Paris and a first ever start in London. And the Tour de France has taken over the center of the city, and one by one, all 189 riders will begin their journey today, which will take them to Belgium, France, Spain, and on into Paris.
So there was a kind of expectation, I guess, which was odd, but I was way out of my league. Sorry, way out of my depth.
Did you feel it?
At the Tour de France, yeah. Like, I'd asked to go. I'd been winning all the races throughout the year, so I'd asked the team if I could have a shot at going the Tour.
This is what you always wanted to do.
Yeah, and ultimately, like, honestly, I lasted 9 days, crashed twice, and I was out of my depth. It's the only event in the world in cycling that you have the 200 best bike riders in the world all at the peak condition of the year. And the consequences of winning are bigger than the sport. It transcends the sport, that race does. And actually, it did the opposite of what I'd have imagined. You know, I could have been quite disheartened by it, but I thought at least I knew the standard I had to be for the next year to go, do you know? Whereas if I'd been at the level and not been successful, I probably would have been more disheartened than if understanding I wasn't at the level and I had to get to that level, you know, and understand the work that I had to do to be able to get to that level. Like, I thought I was good because I'd been winning all year, but I wasn't good enough for that, you know.
But so, you know what, but again, I'm sounding like the psychiatrist chair here, but I'm just so interested to hear what you say, that a lot of people, this is another thing that the wins separate elite sports people, to think there's a challenge there, instead of thinking, you know, that's it, I've done as far as I can. So what did you do then to make yourself better then for the next time you went in?
I trained harder.
Just harder?
I was always naturally, I could sprint, you know. That wasn't the problem, was the sprinting. It was getting to the sprint. And so I had to lose weight, which meant watching what I ate. It sounds stupid because as a cyclist, it should be normal when you're young. But there's a difference. Like, talent can take you so far. I'd always worked hard, but I evidently weren't working hard enough, you know. So that extra hour, that dessert that you cut out here and there, it all adds up, you know. And that's what I did. And as well, you get something from doing a full year. Full year as a professional makes your body stronger, that you can build on the next year, you know. And so that all helped. I was another year stronger anyway, and I could build on that. And that was thanks to doing, say, the Tour de France. Like, even just 9 days, I'd got a depth in my endurance that I hadn't ever had before, because I hadn't ridden the Tour de France. Do you know what I mean? I hadn't ridden 9 days consecutively with the best bike riders in the world.
Is it truly like no other race?
It's horrible.
Is it horrible?
Really, like, horrible but beautiful. We did a meeting this year and before the race on the Tour de France, and there's two guys in my team, and I ride for the most successful team in the world for the last 10 years. They've been the most successful team in the world every year. And so they're the best bike riders in the world. Two of them have done the Tour, and I explained to them that they won't ever look at cycling the same again after the race.
Was it a warning?
Not a warning. I don't know. I just go off on it. It just transcends cycling. You have cycling and you have the Tour de France. You ask anybody. We go out of this building now and ask someone on the street, name a bike race. They're going to say the Tour de France.
Of course.
Even if they don't know anything about cycling.
Mm.
Or even say to someone, name an item of clothing that is given to a winner of a sporting event. They'll go yellow jersey for Tour de France. Do you know what I mean? It transcends cycling. And just the significance of it is the consequences of winning and losing are that much more because of that, you know? And the effect it has on your body, like, it's 3 weeks for a reason, you know? Your body can sustain metabolically for 2 weeks. And for a third week, it starts going catabolic. It starts eating itself. That's why it's 3 weeks long, you know?
Wow, I know.
Like, it's an endurance test. Like, I think a lot of sports, they're games. You compete and you win. Cycling, and they evolved as games.
Yeah.
Cycling evolved. They in the past, cycling was always, it was endurance tests.
Mm.
And then obviously racing came that made it more of a game. But it still holds that value of it's a test, it's an endurance test.
Is it harder, yeah, though, Mark, as a sprinter, to be doing the Tour de France than anything else?
I think physically, yes. But then again, our opportunities to win are make it more worthwhile, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you know, there's fewer riders can win sprint days than can win other days. There's more riders can win different days. Sure. In the mountains, you've got fewer guys as well. But they're kind of, if you take the whole Tour de France and break it into mountain stages, flat stages, other stages, I think you have, statistically, you have a better chance of winning a stage as a sprinter than another one. So ultimately, what makes suffering worthwhile? That's a reward at the end of it. On anything, not just cycling. Like, if there's a reward at the end of suffering, anybody would do it more, wouldn't they? Like, it's not just necessarily physical suffering, but the reward when you've worked hard for something is sweeter, isn't it?
Is the reward good enough for what you're going through?
Honestly, winning a stage of the Tour as a bike rider, can't talk for anyone who doesn't ride a bike, but as a cyclist, like seeing that red banner coming towards you and no one passing you, there's no feeling like it. Like, I often get asked, like, always about winning one more stage of the Tour, stuff like that. And because I've won 30, it might seem like it's easy, but actually, because I've won 30, I'm the one person that can attest to how hard it is to win a stage. You know, like 95%, 99% of bike riders in history have never won a stage of the Tour de France in their
mm-hmm.
whole career.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys that have won one in their whole career, it's made their career. Then you'd be able to name riders that have won two stages or more of the Tour de France in their career, let alone the guys that have won two or more in one Tour. So I think I'm well educated to be able to say how hard it is to win a stage in Tour de France.
I think, you know, that's fair to say.
And it's f***ing hard. Like, you know.
I'm going to be the old romantic again about this, but the times that you've won in the Champs-Élysées, is there a level, because I'm imagining you're going to say each one, they're just as important as each other, but to go down the Champs-Élysées on that last day and win that stage, is that more special? They must feel with the crowds around it. It must be the ultimate.
Right now into the final two bends. A left-hand sweeper followed by the right-hand sweeper into the Champs-Élysées, and that's when you've got to be in second or third position.
Now, where is the Max Missar? There he goes, over the top. Somebody just launched him, and forget it, because Mark Cavendish is streets ahead of the Tour de France when it comes to a sprint finish.
You got kids?
Yeah.
How many kids?
I've got two kids.
Okay. Each of my kids have qualities that I prefer for them than the other kids. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I love all my kids the same.
Yeah.
But some of them have different qualities that I prefer than the other one, if that makes sense. I don't prefer the kid than the other one, but I prefer my daughter's caringness compared to my 3-year-old who doesn't care.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But I like his sense of humour. I still love my kids. Do you know? Like, all the same. They just have different qualities about them.
Yeah.
And that's the same with the Tour de France. I'm not even comparing my Tour de France wins to my kids. That's incomparable.
I know what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying.
I know exactly what you're saying. Songwriters say the same thing about this song. What's the favourite song you've written? They're like my children. So it's the same thing with your Tour de France stage wins.
Still to come, Mark faces debilitating illness, depression and being written off. And then the historic comeback of the Tour de France 2021. I'm Paul Coit, or when we return on My Sporting Life with Mark Cavendish.
My Sporting Life. Paul Coit in conversation with Mark Cavendish on Talk Sport.
By 2016, Mark was one of the world's greatest cyclists. He'd won 30 stages of the Tour de France, won world championships and Olympic medals, and had a huge amount of well-deserved success and highs, but lows were just around the corner. Now, Mark, by the end of that year, something was wrong and you came into a very difficult period of your life. And over the next 4 years or so, you had a lot to live with and a lot to put up with, didn't you?
Yeah, it's not been easy, but I can't profess to have harder times than other people the last couple of years.
Everything's
especially,
relative.
You know, but yeah, a physical illness that I couldn't ride my bike. I had Epstein-Barr virus, which most people have Epstein-Barr virus in their system. And it sounds like, honestly, before I had it, again, I was like, I remember my teammate had it.
What,
10
what is
years
it for
ago.
Those who don't know?
So Epstein-Barr virus is the it's what causes glandular fever. And most people have glandular fever when they're teenagers, you know. But you never lose the virus, it stays in your body. It just goes kind of dormant and it flares up. It's a coward disease that can flare back up if you're physically, emotionally, if you're stressed. Any stress, it'll take its opportunity to rise again, you know. And it's not uncommon in normal people, but endurance athletes, it's a lot more common, you know, because you're under physical stress a lot.
So it's like it's when you run down, basically.
Exactly.
It just hits you then.
Exactly. Yeah. And it can lead to chronic fatigue. And usually, most people with glandular fever, when you remember how tired you were when you had it. I had a big year in 2016. I wore the yellow jersey. I won 4 stages of the tour. I was world champion on the track. I was second in the world championships on the road, second in the Olympics. But that change in between the track and the road is, although it's bike riding, it's bike racing, track and the road, they're completely different sports, you know. It's like rally and Formula One in motor racing. They're both car driving, but they're different. And yeah, it took its toll on me, but I didn't know at the time, you know. Then I started 2017, I'd been training good, but I was tired, I couldn't race, and eventually I couldn't even, just walking up the stairs, and I had to sleep. I was sleeping 18, 19 hours a day, and yeah, like most people, I thought, I'll have a month off, I'll be able to come back. And I did that, but it wasn't nice. Like, you can't do anything. It damages your relationship with your wife, with your kids. And I trained to come back, and I managed to get back for the Tour de France a few months later. And then I was crashed out by Peter Sagan and broke my shoulder. That put me off the bike again. I started training again a couple months later. That was 2017, wiped out. Started training for 18, and things didn't feel right over the winter. And I was like, I'm sure something's still niggling there.
Who do you talk to at this point? Is there the team doctor?
The team doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I don't want to go into it because this has been such a positive year. I want to keep things positive.
We're going there.
Do you know?
We're going there. But, don't you worry, because I just want to... It's the juxtaposition between the two.
No, but we've got to talk about it. There was medical negligence there.
Oh, right. You know? Okay, fine.
And ultimately, I was told I was okay and I wasn't. And as a sports person, if you don't think you're good enough, your instinct is to do more. Mm. Or me, anyway. If I'm not where I want to be, I'll train more. And
you need to rest, right?
Exactly. It's the exact opposite of what you need to get over Epstein-Barr. And so it was in my system that whole year, 18, and I couldn't do it. I got eliminated, time elimination at the Tour de France. So every ride has to finish within a certain time of the winner of a stage of the Tour de France, just so you're not riding easy on the stage you can't win. It's the only time in my career I was outside that time limit. I didn't win. And yeah, I discovered I still had Epstein-Barr virus, you know. Coupled on other things, and like, I'd crashed on my head. I'd had a few crashes, and yeah, things were falling apart. And I developed depression. You know, I got diagnosed with clinical depression. And actually, that's kind of karma, because a year previous, you asked me about people with depression, I'd have gone, it's an excuse. Like, snap out of it. What you want about one? You're just looking for sympathy and you're looking for attention, you know. That's how I thought of it, you know. And it's your job to deal with pressure. It's everyone has pressure in their life. That's how I thought, and that's why I'm quite I'm really passionate about talking about mental health issues now, because I was that person that didn't think it was serious. You know, and it was so damaging to me. It was so damaging to my family. It was so damaging to people around me. I'll never be the same person again that I was before. You just learn to deal with it.
How long was this for? But, how long did this last?
I don't know. Until I could deal with it, I don't even know how long I had it before I was diagnosed. Do you know what I mean? You don't know. And you can't put things in perspective. You either don't have feelings for anything, or you have every feeling in the world for everything.
Yeah.
You're just completely irrational. And it's not something that you have control over. It's a chemical thing in your brain, you know. And things that should bother you, you're flat. It's not like they don't bother you. You don't have the capacity for them to bother you, if that makes sense. Then likewise, like, I use a true example, that there was a spoon with a bit of, hadn't been cleaned properly once, and it ended up snowballing to the end of the world. You know, it's kind of like, well, this spoon's not clean. Someone's not washed it. Someone has done that to, or they don't care that it's not washed. They're going to make me ill.
They want me to be ill. They don't have the respect to clean this spoon. Nobody's got respect for me. No one cares about it. Do you know when you start feeling like it's completely irrational?
You need to talk about it, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's on the onus of somebody who's suffering to talk about it as much as it is for people to ask if someone's okay.
Yeah.
Because one thing you can sometimes think that nobody cares. If nobody knows, it's not that they care or don't care. They don't know, you know, but it's not like, it's hard because it's almost as if you're not aware that they don't know, or you're not aware that you haven't said anything. It's so hard to paint a picture of what it's like because you can't describe what it's like. You can't do it because it's so irrational and so different how you should be able to describe something. But I can preach that it's real, and that if you're looking from the outside, you have to take it seriously if someone's suffering. Because if you don't take it seriously, it's not just doesn't help them get better, it's detrimental, you know? And likewise, if you think you could be suffering, you need to see someone. You really do. And it can be a professional, it can be someone else. I find somebody who has also suffered are the best people to talk to. Because they can understand to a degree, you know?
Yeah.
But I'd talk to the end of earth about it, and it's painful talking about it. Like, it didn't just nearly destroy my life, it nearly destroyed my family's life. And but you have to take it seriously, and I say it because I didn't take it seriously before.
Mark was racing again, but in October 2020, surprisingly, he was dropped from Bahrain McLaren. He finished the Gent-Wevelgem race in Belgium with no team, an unsure future, and as he crossed the line, even he thought that his career was finished.
Mark Cavendish, I can see it, and it was a really hard day for you. I see you're getting emotional. How was your day?
That's perhaps the last race of my career now. So I'm a little bit...
Do you really think this is your last race?
Maybe, yeah.
Mark didn't give up. He spoke to different teams with no joy, and then along came Patrick Lefebvre, Mark's old friend and the boss of De Koninck Quickstep, who signed Mark on the proviso that he would earn minimum salary and had to bring his own sponsor to the team. Now, racing in the Tour de France was really unlikely until an injury to teammate Sam Bennett left a vacancy for the 2021 race for lead sprinter. It seemed the stars were aligning again, and Mark... What did this tour feel like then, after what you've been through, and what was your overriding thing?
It was an appreciation. It was a not taking it for granted, which I'd never taken the work that's needed to do it or the racing.
Yeah.
But I'd taken the whole experience for granted because I did it every year. And then when you don't do it, you miss it, you know? And don't get me wrong, like, it's enjoyment, I enjoy it, but it's hard. It's not an enjoyment like going to cinema or, you know, having a nice dinner. It's an experience.
Was everybody pleased to see you? Were there names that are there? You know, it's Cav's back. It's great to see you. I know Pogacar was a huge fan of yours when he was growing up cycling, and now he's this cycling star, and people, it's like, you know, dad's home. How was it?
It was really nice. Like, it really was. I felt a lot of personal connections with people in the peloton, you know?
Yeah.
Because most of the guys there at that race, I hadn't raced with all year.
Did you talk in the peloton?
And we'd like, but I hadn't raced any big races that year. It was my first World Tour race. Yeah. I hadn't raced at the highest level all year.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you have cycling, then you have World Tour cycling above that, and then you have the Tour de France is even above that. I hadn't ridden a World Tour race. I'd been ridden lower ranked small races all year. And then all of a sudden I'm at the Tour, so most of the guys I hadn't raced with all year. And it was super nice, you know. But you know what I felt more than anything was the public. The French public, the British public, like cycling fans, non-cycling fans, I really truly felt like people were with me, like on that journey with me, like really felt connected, which I hadn't done before. And it was so heartwarming. Like it makes you appreciate being a sports person so much more, you know. And I, on every sports person I ever say, I like kind of push them to kind of try and embrace try and embrace the fans like that you don't do unless you, when you take it for granted, you don't do it. Like, fans are, make the sport. That's what sport is. That's what sport is. It's what football is. It's what cycling is. It's the fans. That's why it exists, you know? And if you can embrace it as a sports person, wow. It's so much more human.
And four more children as well on that 2021. What was the first child like? The first that stage four win? I mean, that must have been... My goodness me.
Well, it made... Don't get me wrong, it wasn't any more special. Sorry.
Oh,
but,
come
but
on.
It made the last years worthwhile.
Cavendish is there. Case Bowl is there. Who's going to win in Fougere? Is it going to be Cavendish? Cavendish takes the stage. Wow.
What a finish. Cavendish is back.
The Max Missile wins in Fougere. Never, ever write off the man who's won 30 stages in the Tour de France, because now it's 31.
You know, whether it was relief, whether it was, you know, like, I don't know the word. It just made everything worthwhile.
Yeah.
All them hard times. Like, I knew I could do it. I knew. Do you know, and it's hard. You can see my face scrunching up as I say this, like, and no one believed I could, and I knew if I just, the pieces were in place, I could do it again, and it made it all worthwhile, like, it was incredible, like.
It was remarkable to watch, to be that person, I can imagine, from what you've been through, Mark, and I see there's that great picture of you hugging, or Eddie Merckx hugging you as well, And I know you've also said that the number to break the record, it doesn't mean that much to you. Is that right? Because I'm looking forward to next year and thinking, and everybody's going to be looking at you thinking, are you going again?
It wasn't even a record till I started winning a lot of Tour de France stages, because Eddie was so far ahead of everyone.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't ever talked about, do you know? Like, it was because it wasn't attainable. It wasn't talked of as a record. Eddie just won 34 stages of the Tour. Then all of a sudden, like, I'm come close to that, so that could break his... But different riders, different eras, and Eddie Merckx is Eddie Merckx. Do you know? Like I said, I know what it takes to win one stage of the Tour, and if I can only win one more, if I can't win any more, if I can win 50 more, I'll just do my best to try and win more. That's it, you know?
2022, then?
I hope so. It's not down to me.
They'd be mad too, wouldn't they? Watch this space.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong. If I could do the Tour de France every year for the next 50 years, I'd jump at the opportunity. I'd commit my life to it. Like, that, it means everything to me in a professional sense. Obviously, my family mean everything to me more. So, but in a professional sense, the Tour de France is my life. And I would, if I could do it for every year for the rest of my life, I'd do it. I hate it. It makes me suffer, but it's the most incredible emotion you can ever get as a bike rider. It's what you dream of as a kid. And if I can take people on the journey with me, if one person gets inspired to ride a bike more from that, or if one person gets inspired to dig in for what they want once more, that makes it better tenfold, you know? That's something that means so much more than standing on the podium with a medal. Like.
Mark, what a way to finish. Thank you so much for sharing your sporting life with us.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
My Sporting Life on Talk Sports.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things.
Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.